Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Errol Yawake. Mike is still out, still alive, yet still out. And so I've asked my friends Kristen Cordell and Sarah Reckless to join me. We talk about Ukraine, we talk about Afghanistan, and we talk about all of our favorite basket of goods and why they are so much more expensive than they were this time last year. It's a really fun conversation. I think you'll see why these are two of my favorite people to talk to about literally anything. So without further ado, let's get to it. Kristen, Sarah, hello. Welcome to News and Brews.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's so good to have y'all on. So for everybody's benefit, I'm sitting here looking and smiling at Kristen Cordell and Sarah Reckless because they're two really good friends, people that I know and trust and love talking to anything and everything about. And so Mike's still out on paternity leave. And so I asked Kristen and Sarah to just come and talk about the news and talk about some other stuff with us. So I'm really grateful to y'all for taking time. You've got busy lives, you've got busy jobs. And so it means a lot that you're here.
But neither of us have a podcast, strangely enough. Although if we did, I think it would be a lot like Delicious Dish.
Ooh, tell me about that. What is Delicious Dish?
Delicious Dish is that SNL skit, remember, with Molly Shannon?
No, I think we need to link it in the show notes, though.
Yeah, okay, link is Delicious Dish, and that's Sarah and I, basically.
Is this the same sketch with Alec Baldwin back in the day?
Yeah.
Where it's the two NPR radio. Actually, Errol and I had a moment in our class earlier this year where we were talking quite directly over our microphones at each other in front of the class that was very similar to Alec Baldwin and whoever else was on the radio show with him on SNL. It was very funny.
Yeah. I'm going to have to go back and this is my deficit in the podcast. Like Mike's usually the pop culture guy that knows all these references and I just smile and nod. So I'm feeling very at home right now.
Errol, I'll send you a clip after this that you can see because it's actually pretty funny.
It's really funny. Yeah.
We'll bring all of that energy because we need all of that energy. But pick a number between 1 to 10, Kristen and Sarah.
3, 7.
Okay.
7 is the number. And so
I
picked 7. So I'm going to intro Sarah first and then I'm going to go to Kristen. I love how y'all participated in that, not even knowing where that was going. That's like trust. As I mentioned, Sarah Reckless is not only one of my favorite people to talk to about literally anything. She and I have probably talked now for dozens of hours about peace and conflict stuff, sometimes over beers and wine, and sometimes in front of students, which I'll get to in a second. She's made a career out of thinking about and trying to build peace in some of the toughest places in the world, from the Middle East to South Asia, to North and West Africa, to even Europe. She's an expert in violent extremism, political transitions, and what stabilization can and should mean in places like Afghanistan and Ukraine. Two places that coincidentally, or perhaps not coincidentally, we'll talk about today. She works for the government now, but she used to work on the Hill and she worked in think tank land. So we have that, all three of us have that in common on defense and foreign policy issues. But honestly, her most important job, probably that she's ever had, is co-teaching a master's level class with me for the Syracuse Maxwell School's Citizenship and School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. So Sarah, really grateful that you came on today.
Thank you. Thank you. I love hanging out and talking about all things. So thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. And we'll have to reprise our like Columbia Road kind of happy hour one afternoon. And Kristen, we might invite you, although you've moved out to the suburbs somewhere. So
no way. I'm still in DC. I'm right down the street.
Okay, fair. All right. Maybe should we invite Kristen?
100%.
I'm waiting. I'm refreshing my email, waiting for an invite.
Kristen also has all the scoops on all the good places with great cocktails. I'm telling you.
I am.
If you want to know where the good cocktails are, Kristen knows.
Pop culture references and cocktails. Kristen Cordell is, in addition to knowing all about pop culture and cocktails, is, in my estimation, a policy wizard. Pretty sure that's her official job title. No, but really, Kristen is not only a friend and a former colleague of mine, she's made a career out of thinking about hard global development challenges, specifically about what the US can do about them, which is not as easy as perhaps it might sound. Almost nothing happens in the longer term, like sustainably on this stuff in Washington without good sound policy. And I think Kristen is pretty much a ninja wizard. She's also one of the smartest and most thoughtful people I know on something that occupies a lot of oxygen in Washington, geostrategic or in some circles, great power competition. For those that don't know, that's Washington speak for China. She spent a year as a Council on Foreign Relations fellowship at CSIS, exploring the role of U.S. leadership in the multilateral system, vis-a-vis strategic competition and all sorts of other fun stuff. So, you know, for the folks that are listening, I won't be offended if you multitask and go over to her page at CSIS and check out some of the great stuff that she wrote in the past year. So needless to say, I'm very much looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This is great. I'm planning to like take the recording of what you said and play it to myself sometime. Just when I'm feeling low.
Just like, you know, I'm available to like announce, like you walk into a room or perhaps like a cocktail bar. I can just do the intro.
Yeah,
this is my exactly. Ninja wizard friend.
I'm drinking tea. Actually, it's still a brew. It's not beer, but it's tea. It's like fennel tea, which is just delicious. Love it.
What is fennel tea?
Well, it's just tea with the soft fennel undertones. So good.
Sarah, what do you have? What are you imbibing tonight?
I'm not drinking anything, but pretty much a glass of water. But I don't even have that on my desk. But that would be my main drink tonight.
Hey, we'll put down high quality H2O for you.
Yeah.
So I have an Aslan Beer Company Power Moves India Pale Ale, which I felt like getting you both on the pod was pretty much a power move. So I felt like it was appropriate. But what do you say? Should we get into the first round?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so we're going to start in Afghanistan today, somewhere where all three of us have spent time in our career. And the six-month anniversary of the end of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan recently came and went. I remember reading so many things and talking to so many people, as I'm sure y'all did too, in D.C. about how that sort of chaotic end last August would linger forever on people's minds. And yet I'm pretty sure that like most people didn't realize it's been 6 months. And I'm guessing like the folks that wrote those breathless headlines have probably forgotten that there's still very much a crisis in and around Afghanistan. So the reason it came on my radar this week is in addition to the anniversary, the Afghan embassy in DC announced that it's closing, which basically because it doesn't have enough money to stay open. And it's really, I don't know if y'all have been there, but it's a beautiful building with unbelievable artwork and just like carpets that are just stunning, understandably so. And it's most recently led by two successive strong female ambassadors. But honestly, it's not the embassy closure that, you know, it was sort of like what reminded me of it, but that's not even a small part of the tragedy here. So I think Afghanistan is, in official UN parlance, up a creek without a paddle. The head of the UN Refugee Agency was there this week, Filippo Grandi. And he said, the whole attention of the world at the moment is focused on Ukraine, which a certain podcast will get to in a bit. But my message coming here is don't forget the other situations where attention and resources are needed. And Afghanistan is one of them. And I think he's saying this in part because appeals for Afghanistan are not getting funded at the levels they need to be funded. The UN appeal, I believe, is around $4 billion this year. And they're still far from that number. Indulge me for a second, back to the rivers and paddles. So in an attempt to punish the Taliban, we, the United States and our like-minded friends have essentially cut them off, thus all of Afghanistan, because the Taliban's in charge. And I'm no friend of the Taliban. I think they're, you know, by and large terrible, but the money being cut off is a big issue. And it essentially means that there's mountains of Afghan money sitting in Western banks. Releasing that money is of course complicated. It's not like, you know, we can just write a check and everything will be done. You know, the Taliban remains a banned and ostracized group, and many of its leaders are sanctioned. It's not like they can receive money anyways. But the intended or unintended effect of that cutoff is that there's no money in Afghanistan. There's basically no economy. And those who can leave have left. Those who can't afford it to leave are trying to leave nonetheless. It's really on the brink of, if not already in famine. And so David Miliband, the head of the International Rescue Committee, said recently that if we wanted to create a failed state, we could not have had a more effective policy mix than the one we have at the moment. So the longer this goes on, the more assistance Afghanistan will certainly need. And I think the longer they're cut off, that $4 billion could double easily in terms of the need. And so I should mention that both Sarah and Kristen are here in their personal capacities. They're not representing any part of the government or their various organizations. I've asked them here because they're really wicked smart and have been to Afghanistan and know lots of things about, you know, conflict in the world. And so you've both lived in Afghanistan. So, you know, how have you been thinking about the past 6 months? Where do we go from here? Maybe Sarah, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually in Nigeria when I heard about when the Afghanistan situation kind of, or when we started to evacuate people. And, you know, it was quite a moment to come. It had been almost, almost 10 years since I've been back from Afghanistan. And so 10 years ago, I was there. It felt heartbreaking because we had worked so hard in that country for so long to try to help support a more sustainable, stable state. And I think despite efforts of very, very, very good and well-meaning Afghans, there were a select few that continued to be, to hijack a brighter future. And then on top of that, you also had the Taliban. And we became exhausted in trying to deal with the problem set that we had chosen for ourselves, quite honestly. You know, it's hard to not have a hindsight perspective on this, but it was a tragedy. And the biggest tragedy really was our kind of the way that we left. And I don't think that the administration really had a lot of good choices. And I think we're going to have to leave Afghanistan at some point. So in that regard, I think there was never going to be, the situation was never going to be perfect. It just wasn't. But certainly it's impossible to not have witnessed or seen what happened and not feel deeply regretful for the people who are suffering as a consequence or who have suffered as a consequence of either being left behind, you know, now being victimized by a brutal regime and who are in actual physical, literal hiding. I mean, those were the reports that I was hearing. I mean, I obviously have tons of colleagues who have served in Afghanistan with me, and all of them were doing everything they possibly could to try to get people out as the evacuation started. So and hearing the reports of young women who had very bright futures literally hiding and hearing that they're on lists to be hunted down and to be forced into either marriage or you know, brutalized by people who had their names and were hunting them. It's horrifying and it's unimaginable. You know, I think at that point, I really genuinely had a moment of like, how can this happen? It was pretty hard. I think, again, there's, as a person who's also had to close down work in places where there's still ongoing conflict, these choices are never easy. And that's not to minimize the suffering of so many Afghans who, you know, all I can think about is that there needs to be a brighter moment, and like there's always hope for a brighter future. And I think that there's some enduring work that will continue in terms of, like, you know, they lived for two decades in a place that was very different than the one that was under Taliban rule, even if it was very flawed and problematic. And I think that you can't take away the education, you can't take away the like other opportunities that happened in, during those times. And we'll see what happens in the future. And hopefully we can play a more positive role. But I don't know in terms of the current situation, like it is, I see kind of both sides of the challenge. And I don't think that, you know, the entire country starving to death is necessarily the right approach. But neither do I see supporting a Taliban regime being the right approach. So, you know, it is definitely not a straightforward solution.
Yeah, I feel like the existence of the tragedy doesn't mean that we have to sort of knee-jerk look for who to blame. And if we are looking for who to blame, then I think we need to be looking in the mirror, and I think we need to be looking back 20 years across that whole thing. So, Kristen, when were you in Afghanistan, Kristen?
Yeah, I was there most of 2017 and a lot of 2018.
Okay.
Or 2016 and 2017. It was several, like, 6 months since. So all at the U.S. Embassy, and probably in a much different security posture than Sarah. Unfortunately, it was just by then so limited, and our ability to get out and interact with everyday Afghans was just so, so different. And, you know, I found the story on the embassy closing really heartbreaking as well. I also had read an article about the ambassador who was sort of carrying on this ghost embassy for a while because she wasn't sure what was going to happen with the government. And I just, it was this remarkable indication of bravery to me that she was still having events and, you know, sitting with service members who'd returned from Afghanistan, U.S. service members. And I just remember being so taken by her ability to continue to serve in the most uncertain circumstances for her country and ours, really. And I just remember being really, really touched by that show of bravery. And I think it goes to Sarah's point about the assumptions that Afghans were making about their lives, their interest in just sort of moving on, carrying on, and building on the gains that they made. When I was in Afghanistan, I actually helped procure the largest ever gender investment the U.S. government had ever made for women and girls in Afghanistan. And it was a remarkable experience because it felt like a wave of progress that wasn't going to be able to be turned back. It was to help 18 to 24-year-olds who had some formal education take the next step into meaningful careers in a number of sectors. And I remember just thinking, this is watershed, because once you get to this point, once you get to this tipping point where people feel empowered to lead their own lives and step into their careers in a meaningful way, you cannot turn back. Like, that's what the research says. Once you get to this certain tipping point of educated, empowered, autonomous people, it's really hard to go back. And I just see now that we were making, and this was, I think, the problem throughout the conflict there, we were making so many assumptions about the ways in which things should work versus how they actually do work. And we were building on those assumptions in a way that made our progress really, really perilous. Like, we could not be sure about those assumptions. We were resting on, you know, very limited information about the sort of wider experience in Afghanistan, as I mentioned, because of the limited sort of security posture and ability to really be engaged with the society at large. And I just think, what would have been a better option for us? How could we have really understood what happened, what was happening, and what could potentially happen in a more circumspect way? And I wish that had been the case. And yeah, just like Sarah, I find it so heartbreaking. But for me, I also, it's really forced me to question, what is good development? What is good development now? And what is the future of good development? And how do we use the tools we have in these incredibly complex situations to work smarter? And, you know, not just think about dollars invested, but the way that we spend them. I think Afghanistan has made us really think about what it means to do infrastructure. what it means to program against certain democracy goals. It's really made us think a lot. And I think the unfortunate thing is that maybe we haven't had the time and space to do that with the pace of things this year. I mean, the government's very lean right now, and there's so many crises around the world, whether it be the COVID response or now obviously Ukraine. I mean, we won't even get the chance to touch on what's happening in South Sudan. So all that to say, I wish there was sort of a bigger thought exercise about the future of these tools and how we could apply them in a way that maybe would help us be a bit more nimble around these types of situations.
And the one thing, I mean, Kristen, one of the things that you kind of touched on that I think is true is, you know, we also, looking back in Afghanistan, some of the lessons, we needed to not kind of skip over some of the hard things that came up, like corruption. You know, I felt a bit compelled by Sarah Shays's article that she wrote when everything happened about never really tackling the issue of corruption. And I think, you know, I don't mean corruption in this like very wonky kind of technical way. I mean, politically speaking, you know, and her argument essentially being that how can we expect people to want to follow a government that is as predatory as the one that was just deposed, even if it wasn't as violent, right? And I think that just stuck with me because I think we sometimes skipped over some of those harder problem sets. And we thought that spending money was going to help us solve those problems. And I think that was a big lesson that we tried to pull out in some future stabilization stuff, right? That it really wasn't the amount of money that you put in. It's how you actually put that money in how you program, the partnerships you build, the kind of being willing to look sober-eyed and clear-eyed at the challenges that you're facing and not trying to skip over that stuff.
I remember having a similar thought, Kristen, to what you were saying about the sort of tipping point, and especially on women and girls and education more broadly. And I remember also feeling like I was naive. And I think that in a way that's true, but I also think that those women and girls that did receive education, many, many, many of them over a 20-year period, they're still, you know, by and large, they're either there or they're alive somewhere else. But the tragedy is that those who are stuck behind are, you know, not able to sort of benefit from that education and access to the workplace and other things that they had. And I think even more tragic, many of them are being forced to leave. And I think what we know from countless, you know, displacement scenarios around the world, that is once people leave, it's hard to come back. And the longer they stay away, even harder it is to come back. And I don't see the Taliban going anywhere anytime soon. And there's all sorts of reports about, you know, ISIS regrouping, and, you know, there are these sort of uniform types in the US talking about how they're preparing for more attacks in the coming year and stuff like that. So I certainly going to get worse before it gets better. And I feel most for those women and children who sort of had, it wasn't perfect. It was far from perfect.
Yeah.
But I think they at least had something to which they could sort of aspire and the sort of the kind of ecosystem through which to, you know, at least envision a future. Should we move on to a more happier topic, inflation?
The worst segue ever. Yes.
I was trying to think
the
about
two things like, that keep me up at night, Afghanistan and inflation.
Yeah.
It's like 1980.
It's all over again. It's like I'm in line at the gas station on my phone looking at Ukraine and Afghanistan. That's essentially the episode that we have here today. Before we get to gas lines.
If only one of us had COVID, it'd be like bingo.
Do we get to drink for that bingo? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to that too in a second. So on the economy, to be honest, I haven't talked about the economy in the past couple episodes because I've kind of been waiting for Mike you know, Mike is my co-host. He's on paternity leave and he's our resident fake economist. And so I've been sort of waiting for him to come back and explain everything, but there were a few sort of big economics related things that happened this week. So, you know, let's just kind of fake it. I was thinking back to how I was feeling as I was reading the news, which I'll get to in a second. I was thinking back to how I was feeling this time last year. And so I was tired, you know, absolutely needing a break, don't we all? But I was also hopeful, right? Like think back to March 2021, we had a new president, Congress had just passed a $1.9 trillion COVID recovery bill. Oprah had a blockbuster interview with Meghan and Harry. We had vaccines on the horizon. And now I feel a bit like the Fed, where I keep like waiting for things to improve before making a big economic decision. In my case, that big decision was, you know, we've been thinking about buying a house to accommodate the pair of girls that we have that are growing up way too fast. And we, of course, lost to someone willing to buy the place for over 30% over asking price.
Did they have one of those riders, the elevator clause?
Yeah, escalators.
Escalator. That's the worst name ever. Like, no, escalator clause, no.
Yeah, so we had an escalation clause too. And theirs was just more ridiculous than ours was. We came in hot and they were like, nope.
What happens when there's two escalators?
So there's a clause that's like,
yeah,
it's just like, it's like an auction essentially that happens like automatically. And there's a clause that says like, whoever has the biggest escalation clause, you basically pay $3,000 more than the second highest. So basically they paid $3,000 more than what our escalation clause were, but they were willing to go into the rafters for this house that was like not worth it. It was like a fine house. It was great, but it wasn't worth it. So inflation is sort of like personally on my mind, I feel like this week because of housing prices. But, you know, in the Fed's case, it seems like they've been waiting for some sort of like post-COVID leveling out before raising interest rates. And that like leveling out never really came. For several reasons, right? So supply chains never seem to quite figure themselves out. Yeah, our Christmas presents showed up on time and we got that damn boat through the Suez, but like odd kinks are still everywhere in the global supply chain. And more shocks are probably on the horizon, including COVID, which we talked about before. It continues to disrupt, right? So like as US vaccination rates increased, other countries didn't get the vaccine supplies they needed. And even if they had the shots, they had demand issues and they had trouble getting them in arms. So COVID is still an issue in much of the world. And now Omicron is tearing through China. Toyota, Volkswagen, Foxconn, and others have shut down operations. So more COVID, more economic disruption. So oil and gas was like, I want in the game too. And so they've joined in the fun. And gas prices were already high before Putin invaded Ukraine. And now I filled up at the pump yesterday for $4.59 a gallon on that. Yeah, everybody knows that one gas station on Connecticut that's like, right. It's like ridiculous. But I was like, I'm literally out of gas. So can't. So I did see today that oil was down to like less than $100 a barrel from a 14-year high peak of $130 a barrel. So maybe there's like a glimmer of hope, but honestly, like $100 a barrel is still high and OPEC's like, nope, not upping production anytime soon. So, okay. So if that all wasn't enough, then we've got Ukraine and Russia produce a ton of food globally. That food isn't getting into the global market. Conflict in Ukraine, sanctions on Russia. So naturally the cost of food is going up everywhere. And even if we in the US, we don't source our food or our oil and gas directly from Russia or Ukraine, but like global shortages of those things and price increases do actually affect us as much as some people who shall remain nameless would like to think we live in a bubble and are isolationists. Like we don't, and we're not. So in part, of, you know, all of these things. Just this week, inflation was reported to be 7.9% year on year, meaning that a basket of goods, so food, oil, et cetera, whatever people put in their basket, was almost 8% more expensive this February than last February. And that's the highest change literally in my entire lifetime. So the Fed, as I mentioned before, has signaled that it will in fact raise interest rates, but it's like a, you know, rock and a hard place situation, because if they raise rates too much too fast, in other words, if they make it too hard to borrow money too quickly, then we risk tipping ourselves back into recession and we just like continue to spiral. So I guess my question to you is, how's your basket of goods doing these days?
We recently bought a house and I think Sarah's looking. So first of all, I think we've totally scared her. The escalator clauses, but something was going to happen.
I thought for a second you said that you and Sarah bought a house, and I was about to get really excited.
No.
Golden Girls living before
we spend a lot of time together, but we have not cohabitated yet. So I think we've scared her sufficiently. You know, I'm also not an economist, but I think that my perspective on this is it's going to have real political ramifications. I mean, how could it not? Like you know, we're all pretty lucky in that I would assume we're not living paycheck to paycheck, but that's not the experience for, you know, sort of a wide swath of Americans who are going to the grocery store and feeling this acutely every day. You can really tell. I mean, I feel like it's about, I would have guessed closer to 10% just based on like sort of weekly grocery bill outcome.
We live in DC. It's probably, there's like regionally adjusted inflation. Like it could be over 10% here. It's just average nationwide.
That makes sense to me. So I think that there's going to be significant political ramifications because people really feel this. I mean, it was shocking that the economy was doing so well under COVID and now has sort of like taken a hit. It really surprised me. And it's really disappointing to hear that the president's sort of in big Build Back Better initiative isn't getting the funding it needs. And there probably won't be a lot of extra funding for foreign assistance. So a lot of huge roadblocks with respect to resources for the types of work that the administration wants to do, but also potentially really big ramifications for how voters make decisions come the midterms and later down the line as well. I don't know. I tend to think that just a really unfortunate situation for families that are struggling in the middle of this country and all over this country, actually, both with respect to what their purchase power is, but also with the realities of COVID still in place. I mean, families are still struggling with childcare issues that have been widely disrupted. There's a lot of issues related to getting back into the classroom. There's a lot of education lag for students, especially at the elementary school level. I mean, these are huge implications. And I don't know that raising or lowering the interest rate will change them, but it'll certainly make it more uncomfortable for people in the short run. So I think there'll be significant ramifications in the US political system, potentially much further down the line. I'm really interested to see what happens with the housing market. I just don't think that it can get any tighter. And one thing I can't figure out, and this would be a good question for the economists, it's going to get harder to buy a house, but it seems like, how could it get any harder? This is not the best question, but how could it get any harder than it is now? I mean, it's just unbelievable at this point. So,
yeah. So Sarah, are you excited about buying a house?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so funny. I really was excited about buying a house and everything's kind of been put on hold. You know, the winter is not a good time to look for homes, but, and we'll see. I mean, I'm too wary of buying something that's valued less for something way more. Like, I just don't do that. It just isn't in my DNA really to pay 30% over ask for a house. Like, you know, forget about it. But we'll see. Like, you know, as you guys have already faced it, this market's pretty hard here in DC. I also grew up in Ohio where, I mean, housing prices are tough there too. But in comparison to here, you know, what you buy there, you get a lot more for your money, to be honest. So it's hard to kind of level set my expectations when it comes to that. I mean, I do think it's interesting because I think we're living through a pretty tumultuous moment in time, which, to be honest, we've probably been in a bit of a bumpy situation for more than a few years. And I think the all of the economic pressures, like the reason why the Fed needs to raise the interest rate is essentially to rein in inflation, right? So we forget that. We think like, oh, they're going to, you know, make or they're going to raise interest rates. This is going to be terrible for the economy. It's actually to try to protect the economy. So for me, I guess I'm like, all right, interest rates have been really low. You know, raising it a little bit isn't going to like, at the end of the day, if it brings down inflation, great. You know, it'll help us in the long run. I think to me, it's, I'm trying to keep my eye on the bigger picture just because it seems like there's so many terrible things happening every moment. There's such, or as what economists, at least the economists that I read say, stiff headwinds. There's a lot of turbulence right now, and we are facing an enormous amount of difficulty. But I think, you know, long-term things seem positive. I mean, we still have a really robust labor force. People are getting jobs. Clearly wage, lack of wage increases is a problem. I know it, there was some relief on that, but it really has been eaten away by the inflation issues. So, you know, I do think long-term, I feel optimistic, but we're definitely going to have some ups and downs for a little bit. And that's just kind of to be expected, especially with the uncertainty that's brought on by this war. I mean, nobody knows how it's going to end. And that's definitely, uncertainty is not what economies like. They like certainty. And that's, but this is, you know, we're not alone in the global shocks to the economy. It's not just the United States that's facing this. This is happening everywhere. So we'll see. I mean, that could also spur some interesting, some interesting reactions, maybe not all good, some good, some not good, right? But yeah, so that's kind of how I look at it. I mean, it's painful and nobody likes it. We all feel, I think, that it's tough. And it's hard right now, I think, to feel like we have grit to deal with all these challenges. But to be honest, this particular moment in time, we really need to have more grit. I mean, it's, life is just calling us to step up a lot more. And it's, I wish sometimes our leadership would come out and make like poetic speeches, you know, like Winston Churchill did. I'm not talking about the Iron Curtain speech. I'm talking about inspirational speeches, you know, that really kind of paint the picture and paint kind of what it is that we're all about, and why it's important to kind of, you know it's hard, but still do it anyway, because it's worth it. It's asking us for courage to stand up for things that are our principles that mean things to us. But
yeah,
who knows? Maybe somebody will make that poetic speech. I don't know. I think we need it now.
Well, but I mean, around the time that this hits people's podcast feeds, Churchill in a t-shirt, aka Volodymyr Zelensky, will be speaking to a joint session of Congress and probably asking for very similar things. So with that, let's get into our main story. I want to talk about Ukraine, but I need to start this part, I think, with something that's been really hard. So I used to live in all these tough places, and y'all did too. And I think before I had kids, it was, you could almost like cognitively disassociate from some of the challenges. And for whatever reason, the bombing of the hospital in Mariupol in Ukraine really hit me hard this week. There was an image captured by an AP photographer of a very, very pregnant woman on a stretcher being carried away. And it just, I had to like shut off my, you know, close my phone and step away for a second, because it really brought home just how horrible this is and how tragic it is for the people, and how really terrible and diabolical Vladimir Putin and his sort of people are being with this. So Mariupol is a port city in southern Ukraine. It's of interest to Putin. He's been targeting thousands of civilians have died in Mariupol, including tragically that pregnant woman. And it's of interest to them because control of it would essentially like connect where his forces are in Crimea, where his forces are like with the forces in eastern Ukraine. So this targeting of civilian infrastructure, including hospitals, is sadly part of the playbook. It's what they've done elsewhere, including in Syria. I know both of you have experience working with and on Syria, and they've done this in Syria. There's a great article in the monkey cage in the Washington Post a couple of days ago, actually around the time of the Mariupol hospital bombing, about how Russia used similar despicable tactics in Syria and how this particular Mariupol strike could just be the beginning of a much darker time in this conflict, especially as the economic screws tighten on Russia and Putin looks for ways to inflict maximum pain with minimal cost. I hate like talking in those terms when it comes to this, but like, yeah, I listened to someone recently talk about how they actually don't have too many like precision guided missiles and munitions. And so they've resorted to these kind of dumb missiles for a lot of their attacks. And so this is, I believe that this hospital is probably targeted as part of this grand strategy, but like they're going to start using weapons that are much more indiscriminate in their targeting. So along the targeting, they did also attack a military base just 15 miles from the Polish border this week, which was, I think, obviously scary for Ukrainians, but also really, really, really close to a NATO ally. And everybody that I talk to, and I, my own fears are always of escalation. And, you know, an attack on a NATO ally is a, certainly a very big thing to deal with. And so it signals that I think Russia knows about the fact that there are goods and weapons flowing across the Polish border into Ukraine. And they're probably also trying to create panic, I thought, and maybe some second thoughts amongst, you know, the Polish people and Polish leaders, which of course totally backfired, because I don't know if y'all saw this, but earlier today, three that we're recording on Tuesday and three EU leaders, including the Polish prime minister and fellow prime ministers from Slovenia and Czechia, hopped on a train and went to Kyiv, despite the continued assault on the Ukrainian capital. And so, you know, certainly a gutsy move, but also a reminder that, you know, support against Putin is largely unified. Of course, not unified enough for them to get fast track membership into the European Union, which they had sought and were not granted fast track EU membership this week. So that was something that happened that sort of was, I think, entirely expected, but still kind of like a bummer for the Ukrainians. So, Kristen and Sarah, I don't necessarily want to, I welcome any thoughts on like bombs and troop movements and stuff like that, but I wanted to talk to you both about like how we should be thinking about like building peace when bombs stop flying and, you know, bullets maybe stop flying, or at least how can we like think about laying the groundwork for sustainable peace within Ukraine? And like, Sarah, I know you've worked a ton on issues like this, both in active conflict and in post-conflict, sort of trying to prevent future conflict. So like, how are you thinking about Ukraine right now? And then Kristen, I'd love your thoughts on sort of the role of the US more broadly in development in this.
I think you're asking some really interesting questions. I guess the thing that's so difficult is that the Russian war, the Russian invasion is so, it is game-changing. And it has been, I mean, you know, one of the people who I love reading her interviews and any of her op-eds is Fiona Hill. And I think she's written a lot lately about the recent events in Ukraine and the Russian war. And, you know, what is interesting that she says is that, you know, we've been at war since 2014, because this was a further invasion into Ukraine. I mean, they did invade both Crimea, annex Crimea and invaded the Donbass back in 2014 and maintained troops there. And this is a further invasion into the country. And we shouldn't be deluding ourselves into believing that the world is the same. And I know that sounds really kind of scary and terrifying. And it's not, it's meant to level set. This is, you know, think about the oil shocks that are happening now. Those are having global impact, right? I mean, this isn't just about one country. It's about the world and how all of the relationships with each country are lining up around this. You know, it is going to matter in terms of what kind of peace we might see. And the thing that I really want to say, and I do mean this to be frightening, is that a Putin world, a world in which he's victorious, is a terrifying, dark, sinister place. It is the Leviathan, right? I mean, it is a world in which countries are constantly in conflict with each other. It is not, that is the kind of longer term conclusion of how he sees the world. It's not a good place to live. A place where, as you mentioned before, civilians, innocent civilians, are slaughtered mercilessly, where dictators, to maintain control, can gas their own people and barrel bomb their own people, as they did in Syria with the assistance of Russia, right? Like, this is where you see children fleeing to safety and their dead bodies washed up on shore. That lays at the feet of these powers that are involved, right? I mean, at least the Russian, Russia's assistance to Syria and Russia's war now in Ukraine. It's not a pretty picture. I mean, in terms of peace, I think the path forward towards peace is one where we try to invest and lay the foundations for something that can stop the violence and lay a foundation for a continuation of kind of more sustained democratic living. Like, I don't see this being, it's not like many other crises. Like, what's at stake here is really democracy and autocracy, and what type of power regimes are going to be successful. We're either going back to imperialism, or we're marching forward into a modern time, or continuing our journey into a modern time. I'd like to hope that progress can continue, rather than going back to, 18th century, 19th century power dynamics. That wasn't a peaceful world that we lived in there. We've had such sustained peace. I wonder if other countries aren't also asking themselves, what they stand to lose with a change in kind of how the world order functions. So I don't know. I mean, that's really, it's hard to kind of think beyond that. But I will say too, in terms of like Ukraine, what is so inspiring to me is, seeing Ukraine, like even in cities that are under siege, they are protesting. They are continuing to voice their opposition to this invasion, to a war of choice by Vladimir Putin, who chose to invade. And they continue to show up and they continue to show their strength. I mean, it's quite awe-inspiring, and every single one of us owes them the deepest, most profound gratitude for showing that courage. I mean, it is nothing but the most courageous acts that anybody can be asked to do in their life. And it's quite remarkable. So I do have, seeing Zelensky's leadership through this crisis, seeing Ukrainians being willing to stand up, talking about their love of their country, showing pride in seeing the future for an independent Ukraine. I mean, how can anybody not stand behind that? It's a vision for anybody it's hard to not be moved by that. And it's hard not to feel that is without question, a right that these countries have, that people have, that's been enshrined in our international system for a very long time, the right to choose one's own government, the right to have, sovereignty.
Well said. I've been also following Fiona Hill, and she's been so great. And she was actually on Ezra Klein's podcast this week, kind of like, it was the clearest and most, I think, terrifying because of its clarity, depiction of Vladimir Putin that I have heard. And she's also got this really great like accent and like like radio presence, which is sort of like goals, but I've really appreciated her analysis here. But Kristen, how are you thinking about this?
She's an American treasure for sure, right?
I've
been wanting to read her new book for a long time. There's Nothing for You Here, I think is what it's called. It's sort of an autobiography of her sort of immigration to the United States, and also an allegory for the sort of nationalist undertones of the administration that she worked for. So it's definitely been on my list for a while. Yeah, it came out this summer, I think. Yeah, so a couple of things. I mean, I echo Sarah's points, just really in awe of the Ukrainians, but also for me, the neighbors, their neighbors. I've been really moved by the outpouring of support by the Poles. I'm Polish. My family, my mom immigrated to the States when she was a teenager. So I feel a connection to the region and just a deep sense of, you know, gratitude that the countries are taking the step to support their neighbors. And I think that it's because they realize what's at stake. And I have deep concerns about spillover into the region, just like you. I think that it's actually pretty likely, both because of the tactical issues you raised, but also because of the fact that this is a power-hungry individual that wants to restore a sort of previous state of the nation and a sort of dominance in the region. And I think it'd be unlikely for him to be successful, air quotes, in Ukraine and not want to sort of continue on from there. I don't think it's a one-off by any means. And I think that the neighbors realize that and are at the same time, both incredibly supportive to those fleeing the country, but also deeply aware of what they may be called on to do to protect their own sovereignty as well. And I think from the Washington angle, I mean, it's fascinating to see the administration come in so clear-eyed about how they wanted to address China's role in the world and to sort of see the national security apparatus shift to take on this global challenge that is just, you know, so unexpected, I guess, despite the fact that, you know, Russia's implications and interests in Crimea had been quite clear. I think that the national security apparatus has really left that conflict on the back burner, so much so as to say that it just wasn't even sort of registering at a certain point. So to come in with a clear-eyed picture of what global hegemon they wanted to take on and very directly on China and to sort of be shifting gears to address the crisis of the day has been really interesting to watch. And I think there's a lot of civil servants and political appointees all working in these government agencies doing, you know, heroic efforts. So I'll just say that as well. To the larger point here about sort of stability in the region, I think I've been watching very closely the way the international and regional organizations have been responding to the crisis. I actually worked for a time at the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, which is actually set up to take on the sort of power dynamics, the power struggle that Russia and the US faced during the Cold War. And it's a consensus-based organization. So it's been really frustrating to watch the OSCE set up to take on the very security dilemmas that the region is currently facing, that the world is currently facing, and unable to actually take them on directly. And OSCE is just a tremendous organization. In addition to having a mandate to secure Europe, they say from Vancouver to Vladivostok, actually, but secure Europe and sort of a lot of the West. It also has deep mandates on gender equality, freedom of the media, a deep bench on trafficking in persons and anti-trafficking in persons, a lot of work on environmental security, which flies under the radar. But in its bread and butter as an organization is on the security side. So to watch them unable to act and unable to take action because of the fact that they're a consensus organization and Russia's a member, participating state, has been incredibly frustrating. I think that it could be an excellent forum for, you know, trying to mediate, trying to come to some sort of ceasefire agreement. It could bring all parties together and sort of a negotiation, or it could, you know, expel Russia as a member and get down to business on, you know, strong statements around the actions taken. We've seen something very similar with the Council of Europe, which expelled Russia as a member. And then Russia actually left the council. I think today they announced it. So it was really interesting. It was like, I'm not fired. I quit.
They sanctioned a bunch of Americans today.
Did you see this? Like Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden.
Well, like, hey,
all the Dems.
No, and also like,
and Lloyd Austin, yeah,
and like Wally Adeyemo, the number two at Treasury, not the number one at Treasury, number two. Hillary Clinton, did you see her tweet earlier today?
No.
Oh my God, amazing. So she basically quote tweeted someone that had said Russia has sanctioned Joe Biden and a range of top U.S. officials. She quote tweeted that, and she said, I want to thank the Russian Academy for this lifetime achievement award.
Like, you're not in the administration, but you are, just by who you are.
Yeah. It was so cool.
Oh, that's amazing, actually. No, so it's been really interesting. And you know, I have been really excited about the current administration's posture on bringing back multilateralism. And I think that there's just been tremendous opportunities with the re-engagement of the Human Rights Council, which we've seen as a forum that had the walkout on during the Russian ambassador's remarks there. But now it's really the time to take what is sort of a symbolic posture. We're back in these organizations, which includes membership and everything. It's really great, into an actual strategic posture where we actually use these organizations to wield some of our political interests and political power and build the coalitions necessary to push back and to have meaningful action within these organizations. And I think by doing so, you know, really will cause us to think about our strategic alliances and do some real accounting of where we want to be associated and how we want to use those alliances in crises. I mean, these are the reasons these organizations were established. And I think we've become very, very comfortable with them during peacetime, not doing as much and sort of noodling around the edges of things. But it could be a really powerful moment to say, not only are we back in these organizations, but we as the American people and American government are going to use them in a specific and engage with them in a specific way to take on what is, you know, a global crisis, a huge global crisis. Like you said, the food insecurity that's going on is having huge reverberations across Africa and the Middle East. And there are organizations set up to take this on, and they should not be shy about taking a stance on what is happening.
Yeah, it's such a good point about how the unification that I talked about, sort of like the unified opposition with some, I mentioned this in a previous episode, but some sort of India and China sized exceptions to that unified response. I never really thought about it as like an opportunity to really bolster those institutions that we've paid a lot of lip service to in the past sort of year, like we're back, you know, America's back, et cetera. Like this is now, it's time to like put up or shut up in a way. And I think that's the OSCE and other NATO. I mean, NATO's sort of the one that gets talked about the most, but in fact, because it doesn't include Ukraine or Russia, it's kind of like waiting on the periphery 15 miles away. But there's probably these other ones, like you said, that this is what they were set up for,
yeah,
right? Like now's their time.
Yeah. And, you know, things like the sustainable development goals, we should be really clear about the impact of a conflict of this size and growing on achieving the sustainable development goals. There should be statements about this is the progress that the member states have agreed to. So what does this mean for the outcomes of this agenda? And we should find some accountability metrics on that.
For everybody that had SDG on their bingo card, that's...
sustainable development goals.
I mean, in a lot of ways, you could maybe use that as a way of making clearer how regressive it will be for this. This war has been for the world, for every country in this world. I mean, it's going to have bad knock-on effects. In addition to like the potential outcomes of it, will also have very, very negative knock-on effects. So, I mean, I think, you know, we forget sometimes, I think, and I'm being super nerdy because this is what I studied when I was an undergrad. But yeah, I mean, but we forget that, you know, Europe was, there was a lot of conflict on that continent for a long time, right? I mean,
yeah,
what we're talking about here is peace and security and, you know, and people having the right to kind of choose their own government. I mean, in some ways you can see a lot of this as a reaction amongst elite groups such as Vladimir Putin being in power, right, to, you know, a threat to those types of regimes. And they may have felt empowered recently because of populism that's been spreading around the globe, and you know, ethno-nationalist factions that have popped up in some places. But when it comes down to human beings as individuals have the ability to make a choice of what kind of future they want to have. Every individual human being does. And when I look back and I read back, and this sounds super dorky as well, but when I read accounts of the World War II, it's not just the like Winston Churchills and the FDRs that actually helped make that outcome, right? It is literally every single person who was involved in that conflict. Every individual who made choices around saving themselves, protecting themselves, moving, doing bold acts of courage to help other people. I mean, that is really what kind of led us to the outcomes that happened. And I think similarly right now, people chose to anchor themselves towards something that would be a brighter future. And I think we can also do that. Every individual has the capacity to do that. I know that sounds really lofty and maybe a little detached, but it's actually incredibly important to do, because if we don't, then we lose sight and we allow inflation to, you know, make us angry and like, you know, send us to the street and support really dangerous actors who will take us in a very different direction that will be about their own selfish, greedy, powerful natures and not about kind of supporting as best as we possibly can, maybe flawed as well, a government that is governed by the people for the most part, right? So I know that sounds a little idealistic perhaps, but I think it's actually very true. I think if you don't have that passion and that belief, then we're kind of doomed if we don't.
All this talk of rights, by the way, I'm about to like go protest, Sarah. I feel like I'm like, like in like democracy, like fired up. I found this kid's book that I had bought a while back, last time I was in Geneva, and the before times I went to the UN bookstore at the Palais de Nation, and I bought this book called We Are All Born Free, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights in Pictures. And so I've been reading it to my four-year-old every night, and it's great. No, definitely like hand on heart, like all moment, except tonight my wife was reading it because I was upstairs preparing for the podcast, and she was doing bedtime. And I went downstairs right as she got to it's basically like, there should not be torture is like one of the rights. And there's like a picture of a Raggedy Ann being tortured. And I was like, and she was like, Errol, what the hell is this? And I was like, I'm sorry. Keep going. The book is fabulous. And I love the focus on the human rights, but that's a little bit dark.
Don't show the pictures. Yeah.
I'm actually reading Fukuyama's The End of History to my toddler. So it's totally the same thing, right? I'm just kidding. I'm not doing that.
Yeah, you totally. I wouldn't put that past you, Kristen.
I mean, if there was a picture version, maybe. Like all of this talk makes me want to reread it, you know? Like we really did think we were on an upward trajectory of democracy building that was going to last forever. Like just the sort of like hubris around that has allowed like political factions in this country to develop, you know, and sort of like our languishing around like the democracy as a being taken for granted has really allowed us to become quite complacent.
Yeah, we forget what was at stake, right? But like a country is like, you talked about Poland, Kristen, or like any number of Central and Eastern European country. It's not that long ago that they actually made it into NATO or became EU member states and had to go through enormous change to be able to do those things. And frankly, like, I mean, I know there's been a lot of different trajectories, but like for us, I think we just forget sometimes how meaningful that is and how important that is. And it's not small. Like we talked about this actually with our class when we did the Great Power Competition this year, you know, because, you know, you can hang out to dry the myriad flaws that the United States has. I mean, there are many, and, you know, we should criticize and we should debate and we should argue and we should, you know, nug that stuff out and be reasonable and try to actually do it with purpose, right? Like fight with each other so that we get to something that is actually better and that is an answer, not just for the purpose of fighting, which unfortunately, sometimes I think that's where we get stuck. We're talking about like how flawed sometimes the US can be or how the liberal international order. And, you know, it's like, well, but what's the alternative and what's better? Like, is there something better? I mean, right now we're talking about autocracy, and do we really want to like subject people to a regime like that? These are the choices that we have to make. You would never want to condemn somebody to live in a place where they're basically at the mercy of an elite class that has all the powers and all the lever and all the wealth, while you just are, you know, suffering as a consequence underneath, without choice, without an ability to kind of make change, right? I mean, that's the worst outcome.
I feel like I could sit here and drink fennel tea with y'all all night, but I think we should move on to some spicy nuggets. Kristen, do you have a spicy nugget?
Well, I love podcasts that tell the listener what the person is reading right then. So I try to have one non-work, non-child book that I'm reading at any given time. That's like my practice. And so right now I'm working my way through a book called Reality Plus, and it's about the idea that we might be in a virtual reality simulation. And it's actually written from like a very scientific standpoint, looking at the evidence that we are or are not in a virtual reality simulation. And the author thinks that there's about a 1/3 chance that we are. So thoughts?
So this is what you were reading for fun as your non-work, non-kid book? Let me take Ready Player One, but make it real.
When you say it like that, I mean...
Sounds it's okay. Not great. I just finished reading a book on Chicago World's Fair, Devil in the White City. It's a couple of decades old now, but it's such a good book. So that's my, I also try to have a book that's like non-work related, non-kid related, but that's really funny. Sarah, what's your spicy nugget?
My spicy nugget. Well, I had a joke that a friend sent to me. I've been looking for jokes. So this is, I feel like humor is like the best thing in the world and I need to laugh more. And, you know, anything that's like punny or, my friend gave me a list of books that are like funny that I'm going to read too, because I feel like just laughter is the best. And if you guys have never read Naked by David Sedaris, oh my God, laughed so hard in a lunchroom at work. I'm reading this book, laughing out loud, and people are staring at me because I'm just like, I can't control my laughter. It was so funny.
You also have a great laugh, Sarah. Oh,
thank you. So somebody this week sent me a picture. You know how Starbucks, like nobody ever spells your name right?
Yes.
As a Sarah, they always put an H on the last name. I don't really care about it, but
my name is anyway. Errol Yabake. You're preaching to the choir.
Yeah. Oh, Errol. I can't even imagine. So you'll appreciate this. So she sent me a picture of a mug or like, you know, one of those coffee to-go coffee cups with the name written on it. And there's like a little quote on the what the person said to them when they were ordering it. It says, it's Mark with a C and it's spelled C-A-R-K.
It's great.
It's like my favorite thing ever. I mean, like, oh my God, it's my favorite thing. It just made me laugh so hard. I'm like, yeah, Mark with
that's
a C.
That's so heart. Funny. I could totally see that like happening in real life. My spicy nugget is, so there were, we didn't talk about it in the first round or main story, but South Korea had some big elections this year. And there's this guy named Andrew Pang on Twitter who is quixotically at the AP journalists. That's his Twitter handle, except I don't think he has any affiliation with the Associated Press. So that aside, he has a tweet that says South Korean election graphics are next level. So there's this entire tweet thread that he basically takes these short clips of the presidential candidates. And some of it is actually the presidential candidates looking, oh, there's a, you know, percentage in front of their name. Like, how are they doing in the polls, et cetera. And then there are these ones that are like the two main candidates are speed skaters. And it's like their face superimposed on these like speed skaters that are competing. And then there's one that's like, it's a wrestling match that they're going after each other. And that's like really good graphics, but also what? one guy's on a motorcycle, the other's on a car, and they're like racing through the desert or something because there's lots of deserts in South Korea. So it's just like this fascinating, I went down a complete rabbit hole with this and started Googling a whole bunch of stuff. So we'll link
that. I feel like we don't want to share this with too many people because it's the only way CNN election coverage could get worse.
Oh yeah.
Like, can you imagine if they tried to do this at CNN? Like, this would be messy.
I kind of want to see like Wolf Blitzer and John King's heads on some of these like big teddy bears who are going around the screen. Kristen, Sarah, thank you so much. This was really, really fun. I could talk to you all night. I probably will talk to you very soon. We should get fancy cocktails and sit outside now that the weather's getting nice, but really, really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for having us.
News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabake. Our producer is Alana Evans. Our guests today were Kristen Cordell and Sarah Reckless. This episode was recorded Tuesday, March 15th, 2022 at 8 p.m. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.